Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our special guest today is Matt Wagner of Target 10 Advertising. He'll be telling us his memories of some of his favorite bars in New York City. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you so much.
I'm kind of excited to hear a little bit about your stories of the bars in New York City. We haven't really covered that very much. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your situation in New York, and then we'll go into the bars that you kind of remember most fondly.
Yeah, sure. So just as kind of some quick background and setup, I'm a native New Yorker. I grew up in Brooklyn. But all the way on the far southern end near Coney Island. So Manhattan was still kind of an hour away. It was this kind of fun, exciting, fanciful place that I went to with my parents on weekends. And I actually wound up going to college at Columbia. So I was in the city, but also kind of all the way uptown, a bit removed. And I was never a super social person and kind of in the nightlife space. Obviously, I was also underage, very focused on my academics. And so I didn't really go out very much in college. I did occasionally, but nothing too much. And again, my options were limited being under 21. But I had started to watch Queer as Folk in high school. And so I had seen Babylon and I saw what it was like to have this group of gay friends to kind of go out with and party with and, you know, share your time and lives with. But I didn't really have that in college as much as I wanted it. And so when I graduated from school, which was in 2006, I made it a point to kind of seek out gay male friends my age, you know, in their early 20s to go out with and sort of start experiencing nightlife in a real way for the first time and everything that comes with nightlife, bars, clubs, et cetera. And so I was actually living in Bushwick at the time, which is a part of Brooklyn off of the L train. And it was kind of an up-and-coming area. It was still very, very early in the gentrification process. Bushwick is very gentrified now. This was much earlier. And so for me at that time, Hell's Kitchen was the place to be. You know, that was back when Hell's Kitchen was first starting to develop as the new Chelsea, so to speak. For those familiar with kind of the evolution of gay nightlife in the city, you know, the West Village has always been a standby for LGBTQ bars and nightlife and other things. And then Chelsea certainly was for a while, but due to, I think, just rising costs for, you know, rentals and even just the kind of people that lived there, the party boys in Chelsea that went out in the 90s were a little bit older at this point. They maybe weren't going out as much. And so all of that energy sort of shifted up into Hell's Kitchen. And suddenly there were like 5, 6, 7 gay bars all within blocks of one another. And so it was really exciting as a young gay man to kind of go out in that area and have access to this wide variety of really fun, brand new bars. And so that was kind of where my nightlife education, so to speak, started in a real way. And one in particular, which actually none of these three, I believe, are still with us anymore, but certainly this one is in, and that's Vlada. That's V-L-A-D-A. And Vlada is actually named after the owner, who's a Russian woman named Vlada von Schatz, which kind of sounds like she might be a Muppet or something, but she's a real person who owns this bar. And I believe now owns the restaurant Russian Tea Room, or she owns another Russian food venue now. But this bar was really cool because it was kind of, it kind of combined elements of like old school Russian culture. Like they made a ton of their own flavored vodkas and they were all kind of lined up on a shelf behind the bar with all sorts of interesting flavors. And this was like a little bit before kind of flavored vodka was ubiquitous everywhere. And the bar itself was covered in a layer of ice to kind of complement this vodka theme, which was very cool. Because Hell's Kitchen was still, I mean, it is today still, but especially 15-ish years ago, it was kind of grimy. So this bar was very sleek. It was very fashion forward. And so were the people that went there, maybe except for me. But it was a ton of fun. And it was on 51st Street, And if anyone's 51st Street between 8th and 9th Avenues, and it was kind of one of those, like, if it were a house, it would have been the garden apartment. You'd kind of go down a couple of stairs to get in. And there was this first floor, or kind of almost like a basement floor, that was very, very long and narrow. And then a staircase to get up to the second floor. And this was the kind of bar that was always, like, packed to the brim. You know, certainly Thursday through Sunday, anytime after 10 or 11, it was like squeezing through bodies to kind of get anywhere, which was fun unless you had to go to the bathroom. Then it became a bit of a nightmare. But it was a great bar. You know, reasonable prices. They actually had some food as well. I think actually some Russian inflected food, which is also kind of novel for gay bars, which didn't tend to have anything more than like bags of Fritos, if that. And the downstairs area was very much just socializing, hanging out. And then upstairs, they had this teeny tiny little stage. It couldn't have been bigger than the size of like a desk. And they would have some performances from Queens. I can't recall exactly who used to perform there back in those days, but it was some of the more, I think, kind of original New York Queens, like Shaquita, others that have kind of been around for a little longer. I remember a lot of, there used to be tons of birthday, it was like the go-to spot to hold birthday parties and other events in that upper room. They were very helpful about sort of providing you kind of private space without paying anything, as long as you kind of brought enough people to buy drinks, of course. And it was just an iconic part of the landscape. It was one of those bars. It wasn't a late night bar for me, at least, and my friend group. It was more of an early kind of like, you know, 10 to midnight sort of place. And then, of course, there were tons of other bars all around it. But the Blotted definitely holds a special place in my heart as being kind of one of these like fancier starter bars, you know, for a kid that was 21, 22.
Yeah, one of the reviews that I read on Vlada a while back had referred to it, and I thought this was kind of humorous, as a gay-infused vodka bar.
I like that, yeah.
And I know that they were famous for their own home-infused vodkas. They had kind of these funky glass jars that they would put random assortment of spices and fruits in there and make their own special, you know, whatever, cayenne lemon vodka or whatever it was for that particular time frame.
Yeah.
And they, even though they were kind of an elegant bar, it also seems that they had kind of a whimsical sense of humor. I mean, I've seen some of their ads that feature some of the drag queens that perform there, and they don't take themselves super serious in those ads. Was that the case in the bar as well? Was it kind of lighthearted, or was it a pretty serious place?
That's an interesting question. It certainly wasn't serious, that's for sure. I don't know that it was lighthearted necessarily either. I mean, I think it was, you know, I think the ownership, whether it was Lotta herself or her team, were very sort of aware that they were part of the beginning or the emergence of a different sort of community in Hell's Kitchen, as sort of queer people were starting to come into the neighborhood more and more. So Hell's Kitchen is an old, old neighborhood with kind of old school, like Irish immigrant roots. And so a fairly drastic change from, you know, what it used to be like even just 20, 30 years ago. And so maybe just their sort of awareness of being part of the fabric of that disruption in the neighborhood, and I don't say that in a negative way because things change, maybe contributed to some of the tonality of how they expressed themselves. And they also knew they were catering to, I mean, the guys that went there were all pretty much in their 20s, maybe early 30s. It was a very young place. And so probably also just in catering to people of that age. And this is, you know, it wasn't pre-Facebook, but like, you know, pre-Instagram, pre-Twitter, pre all that stuff.
Right.
They kind of had to, if you can believe there was a time like that, they had to sort of make their mark in some way. So I could see that being part of it too.
Oh, I certainly can believe it. I'm a good bit older than you. And I first started my gay bar experiences in the late 70s. So about 30 years before you started. And at that time, Hell's Kitchen was not a place that you would go for nighttime entertainment without several bodyguards and probably some sort of a bulletproof vest. So the whole nature of that area has changed quite substantially in the time from when I first, you know, went there to now. In fact, you live in New York now, correct?
Yep.
There's a new bar that just opened up in Hell's Kitchen, right on the edge of Hell's Kitchen and Times Square area, called The Q.
Yep.
Which is another kind of fancy, over-the-top, three-story, multi-purpose club that I would not have expected to have opened there, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago. But yet, apparently, they are quite successful so far. They've been open for a few weeks. And every post I see from them on Facebook, it looks like they're packed. So Vlada had a good idea opening up something in that area and kind of opening the floodgates.
Oh, 100%. And actually, I was just reading in a local publication, West 42nd Street, that Q is one of either three or four new gay bars that are all coming to this general area, two of which I'm right here on 44th and 9th. I think one's on 44th and 10th, another's on 46th and 10th. So even after the pandemic, which unfortunately closed, you know, several gay bars, including Barrage, which I'll talk about later, it's nice to see that it's not like folks are giving up. If anything, it's, you know, creating even maybe a mini renaissance again, which is kind of cool to see.
I agree. When I interviewed Frankie Sharp about the opening of the Q, that's one of the things I said to him, that a lot of people are concerned because so many bars have closed. Of course, my research goes way back into the 50s, 60s, even beyond that, into the early days of gay bars. And I've already uncovered well over 1,300 bars that have come and gone, gay bars, across the country. But even in the last 18 months, there have been dozens of long-term bars that have just vanished from sight. Some of them opened 30, 40 years and are no longer with us. So, yes, I told him it was very refreshing to know that somebody had put that kind of an investment, not in a tiny hole-in-the-wall neighborhood bar, but, you know, a multi-level entertainment complex at this time, that was very refreshing and kind of bodes well for the future. Now, we've talked about a couple of the bars that that were memorable to you. And Vlada, of course, was a little bit on the posh, elegant vodka martini bar kind of concept. And the next one is Sugarland, which is almost diametrically opposed to Vlada. I mean, they don't even belong in the same category, really, as far as I can tell. Tell us a little bit about Sugarland.
So Sugarland was a lot of fun. Sugarland was like a den of iniquity a little bit. And a lot of that had to do with this location and just its physical space. So, like I mentioned earlier, I was living in Bushwick, and Bushwick is kind of adjacent to Williamsburg. Bushwick's technical name is East Williamsburg Industrial Park, I think, or at least it used to be when I lived over there. And so Sugarland, where Vlada was more of an earlier spot for at least my friend group and myself, Sugarland was like, you get there at 2 a.m. And it was on North 9th Street in Williamsburg. And I actually don't know what that area looks like exactly right now. Probably not too dissimilar. But Sugarland was literally, it's an area of like low slum warehouses and like fish related venues and things like that. It's not a commercial district. There's not retail. There weren't really even apartments. Maybe there were like artist lofts, things like that. It wasn't necessarily a bad neighborhood. It was almost more like a neutral, vacant sort of area. And Sugarland was in this tiny little, I think it was a one-story building that literally had nothing else around it on the entire block. There was like a big empty lot to the left, I think, and to the right, maybe there were some vacant apartments. So like it was alone. There were no neighbors to make noise complaints. There was barely any streetlights. And it kind of looked like that inside too. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it was just like stuff was broken. You know, the bathroom smelled like pee all the time. The doors didn't lock. It was one of those places. But it was at the time too when there was some really, well, there's always great advances in music, but this is kind of when like electro and things like that, electro house, were becoming much more popular. And so there was a lot of like really fun kind of vanguard style music being played, DJs, go-go boys, actually a really popular go-go boy who's become a huge Instagram personality, Matthew Camp, started as a go-go boy at Sugarland. And I met him there, and I've worked with him on a couple of occasions since then. But it's funny to think back all those years ago when he was just a twinkie little go-go boy, and now he's like a fashion designer and among other things. But yeah, it was just like they would have, I remember it was kind of a single big open room with a bar at the front that sat maybe 12, 15 people, and then kind of a smallish dance floor, some kind of go-go boy boxes placed around. And there was almost like this seating pit to the right that you kind of go down a couple of steps that was like a little more where you could take a pause from the action. And then I think there may have been some kind of VIP area in the back, VIP area, maybe elevated, like up some stairs, but the whole space was open. And it was just one of those places, like didn't close at 4, no one knew, no one cared. Sometimes you could stay there until 5, 6, 7, 8, depending on the night and what was going on. And just like club kid type characters would go there. So, you know, this is also when I think there was a little more like awareness of sort of the 90s club kid aesthetic was starting to come back a little bit more at that time. And so a lot of those people actually lived, I think, in those areas, in Williamsburg, in East Williamsburg, in Bed-Stuy, because those were the cheap places that young people could afford to live. And so Sugarland was definitely a hub for like that more artistic Suzanne Bartsch, Kenny Kenny style, but it wasn't those exact people. It was like a different set of those people. It was almost, I would say, sort of the beginning of the Brooklyn club and nightlife scene, which is distinct in many ways from even some of the club kid elements that were very Manhattan-based. I'm certainly not an expert in all of this, but I do remember that there were some like really, really fun, inventive looks. I was not one of them. I'm not creative like that. But it was always like a spectacle to go there, aside from the music and aside from everything else. And the drinks were cheap and strong.
Yeah, from the pictures I've seen of the club, it almost looks like somebody converted their basement into a nightclub or something, in a kind of wood paneled walls, very eclectic decor, just random yard sale finds or whatever, a lot of clutter around the bar with all kinds of little tchotchkes set up there with the liquor bottles. And it looks to me like the crowd there was diametrically opposed to what you would find at Vlada. It looked like it was a lot more interracial, like it was a wider age range. It looks like everybody from twinks to probably people in their 40s, 50s, possibly even older, and some women, which was a little bit different. I think Vlada was pretty much a young kind of twink white boy bar almost. So this was a complete divergence from what, you know, what that was like. And this was in generally the same time frame. I mean, you would go from like Vlada to Sugarland, or?
Yeah, well, so they did coexist. I can't recall. I think Sugarland might have actually closed before Vlada did, but neither lasted. I'd have to double check when they did close. Sugarland closed somewhat just like abruptly, if I recall. And it was it took a lot of us by surprise. But what we would do is, since I lived in Bushwick, and it was always like to get from Bushwick to Hell's Kitchen is a real schlep. You know, and no matter how you do it, train, car, whatever. And obviously as like a poor kid, I'm not taking cabs back and forth. I mean, honestly, at that time, a lot of cabs wouldn't even take you from Hell's Kitchen to Bushwick because they wouldn't make a fare coming back. Bushwick was dangerous, et cetera. But what we would do is we'd, let's say, be in Hell's Kitchen, go to Vlada, go to Therapy, go to Barrage, go to some of these other posh in the area. And then when we'd start heading home at 1 or 2, we would make a pit stop at Sugarland. And that was usually like the triangle. It would be from like the apartment in Bushwick all the way out to Hell's Kitchen to do that for a few hours, swing around to Sugarland, do whatever we're going to do there, and then head back to my place, or we would kind of split up from there. But it definitely, I think it, hearing you say that does make me feel like it was kind of before its time a bit, and in the context of being very inclusive in a wide range of ways, age, race, gender. Actually, speaking of Matt Camp, one of his best friends was a go-go girl named Lauren, which was not you wouldn't typically find female go-go dancers. She's, you know, straight woman, straight cisgender woman. But she was very much built into the fabric of that place. And I think that was also just sort of refreshing because, you know, when everyone kind of looks the same at a bar like Vlada, like, sure, if that's what you're into, fine. But to go to a place where it just feels like, you know, the floodgates open in terms of who you're seeing and being exposed to and becoming friends with, that's the other thing. Vlada and a lot of these places that are kind of these like stand and pose type bars, people were not always the friendliest. They weren't nasty, but, you know, it was very kind of, I think, you're kind of just either with your friends or you're looking to hook up. It's not like mix and mingle. Whereas Sugarland, I actually made a lot of friends at Sugarland because it just was more open in all sorts of ways.
Right. There's a lot of bars like that. We used to call them in Atlanta, we used to refer to them as S&M bars, stand and model.
Stand and model. Yeah.
And we had several of those and they tend to be very cliquish. You know, yes. You have your little band of 6 friends that all think you're each other is beautiful, and you stand there and talk to each other and ignore everybody else around you. So obviously Sugarland was completely the opposite of that. And it had a completely different vibe. Now you also mentioned another bar going back to Hell's Kitchen called Barrage, and Barrage, from what I've been able to determine, seems like it was on some level a little bit of a compromise between the Vlada aesthetic and the Sugarland. Am I mistaken, or was Barrage kind of Latino oriented? It seems like they had some sort of a Hispanic theme running through some of their events and their go-go boys and things like that.
Yeah, so the reason I kind of saved Barrage for last is because it's funny you say that, because it does kind of fall in the middle a bit. I'd say it leans a little more towards Vlada than Sugarland, but what I really liked about Barrage, which was open up until pre-pandemic, and now as you and I were talking about over email, it does seem like there's not been like an official notice of closure, but it does unfortunately seem closed. Barrage was very much both a neighborhood hangout spot, happy hour place, as well as a late night, like bangin' crowded place, which was not common. Usually it was one or the other. You know, you'd have 9th Avenue Saloon, a couple blocks down from Barrage. That was the epitome of like a neighborhood gay dive bar, not really like a late night spot necessarily. And then you'd have places like Vlada that were not as much happy hour hangouts, more for kind of, you know, mid to late evening. And Barrage, like, it could code switch really well. I don't know necessarily, I do think they had some theme nights, and that may be some of the like Latinx aspects that you came across. I'm not totally sure. I didn't actually tend to go to Barrage late night. I was more of, I liked it more for its happy hour. And that was actually why I continued to, you know, as I got kind of into my 30s in relationships, things like that, I just didn't go out as much, didn't interest me as much. But Barrage was always there. It's 2 blocks from my apartment. Great happy hour specials, great frosé. It had a very, it had a calmer atmosphere. Some places, you know, some of these gay bars, even for happy hour, the music is like banging. It's really loud. You can't have a conversation. Barrage wasn't like that. And something that was nice about Barrage too is you could, everyone and anyone would go there. And it was, it had a neighborhood feel in that way. So I'd go there with girlfriends. I'd go there with gay friends, even some straight friends. Everyone liked it. Everyone was welcome. It's very, it had a very easygoing vibe. It was a little rundown, you know, just from years of use, but it didn't matter. And, you know, you'd have, I remember actually my friend Brie and I, it was kind of our go-to spot actually. So she and I mourned its disappearance pretty strongly. But almost any time we would go, there'd be this gentleman, maybe in his 50s, who would show up by himself, pull out a laptop, and, like, do some work. Which, like, you don't really see that in gay bars very often. Like, people kind of using it like a Starbucks almost. And he was a little unique in that way, but I liked that he felt comfortable enough to just show up, sit down, get a beer, do whatever he was doing, hang out for a few hours and leave. And I actually, even though we didn't really, you know, we would exchange looks and say hello now and then. I don't know his name. I don't know who he is, but I liked that there was a gay bar where I could have that kind of interaction with a member of the community, even if it didn't go beyond, you know, just the quick hellos here and there.
Right. Now, one thing I noticed in my research on Barrage is several of their ads focus on happy hour specials and interesting drinks. I have repeatedly seen a drink menu with cocktails that they named Twink, Jock, Cock Ring, Crystal Carrington, Golden Shower, Treasure Trail. Did you ever try any of those? Or were you pretty much just like, let me have a vodka tonic or...
Yeah, no, it's so funny. I'd forgotten about that. I do remember those. And I remember, especially when I was younger, I was like embarrassed to have to order them. This is, you know, when I still had some innocence left. I'm more of a martini guy because a lot of those drinks were sweet. I do remember the frosé, like I said, was really tasty. But no, that drink menu was a lot of fun. And it stayed that way for quite a long time. And I remember something that was also really popular about that place. Again, I didn't do this as much because for me it was more of a happy hour place. But they were unique in that they would redo their happy hour, I think, either from 10 to 11 or 11 to 12. And so suddenly, especially if it's like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you know, a lot of the other places in Hell's Kitchen, including Vlada, were not cheap for the time. You know, a vodka soda could be $8 or $9, which in, you know, 2009 was like a lot, especially when you were poor. And so to suddenly have this bar for 1 hour, have these drinks that would cost $9 everywhere else, go down to like $4 or $5, would pack people in. And it was a really smart strategy because no one else did it. I'm almost surprised no one else did. But that was like a big feature of Barrage that I remember.
Yeah, and it seems like the male body image was part of their whole kind of decor concept. I've noticed in many pictures of the interior of the bar, the walls were lined with like 8x10 pictures, framed pictures of hunky models that I don't know if they were there to intimidate the patrons to, hey, you're not as hot as you think you are, or to make them feel like there were, you know, some kind of possibilities for hot guys showing up at the bar. But do you remember that with seeing the pictures all over the walls of every Calvin Klein and Versace model, I think, that ever existed?
I do. I'm glad that you mentioned that because I'd kind of forgotten that. And they also had, I think it was female pinups in the bathrooms. They had two bathrooms, a private stall and a kind of shared one. And they had almost like Playboy female models in those in various states of erotic undress. But no, yeah, I mean, I never really thought much about the pictures in terms of like what their intention was or wasn't. And they were kind of like, they were older, so they kind of had that older, like 80s beefcakey sort of thing, which never really did it for me. So I didn't really think about it one way or the other, but it was always a fun decor element. And, you know, something that was also nice for those of us who appreciate kind of stability, Barrage just kind of didn't change. Like, from the time I started going to Barrage in, you know, 2007, all the way through 2019, 12 years, they would refresh it now and then, but it kind of had the same essential look and feel, which I liked because
right.
it was like a connecting thread from my younger days when I'd go out a lot to bars that either no longer existed or had completely revamped themselves, you know, for understandable reasons, through my older days when I was just like going out to have a quick drink with a friend after work or something. And there was something really nice about kind of just knowing Barrage is always there. It's going to kind of look the same. It's not going to be crowded. They know your drinks. They recognize you, like all of those sort of comforting things. So I think that's maybe also part of the reason it hit harder when it closed versus some of the others, that I didn't have that as much of an emotional connection to in that way.
Right. It's kind of like grandma's house when she throws a new doily on the back of the sofa. You know, something's yeah. a little different, a little fresh, but it's pretty much still grandma's house.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing that was really nice about Barrage, it's a small space. I mean, a lot of the bars in Hell's Kitchen are small because everything is very compact over here.
And expensive.
But it was a kind of a nice square. But they had a almost like a garage door front. With glass paneling. So during the winter, when it's closed, obviously, that thing is down. But then when it was spring, summer, otherwise nice out, they would pull the doors up and you would just be, you know, they'd kind of push the tables out onto the street. I mean, obviously now street dining is everywhere, but it was a bit of a different, had this kind of nice, airy, open feeling that was also very welcoming and inviting versus like, you know, doorman at the door, black windows, it's, you know, things like that, where it feels more closed off or exclusive or things like that. Barrage never, ever felt that way.
Yeah, definitely, from the pictures I've seen, looks like it had a certain degree of openness to it. The ceilings were not particularly low either. So you had a little bit of extra height there as opposed to, you know, like Sugarland, which to me looks very kind of dark and basement-y. This looks yeah. more open and lofty. And in some of the pictures I've seen, they have little like Christmas twinkle lights or something in the ceiling to give that illusion of like an, you know, starry night, or I don't know what the purpose was, but it just kind of opens up the space a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little kitschy, but like in a good way. And actually one other thing that was always, this is such a like minor, you know, minor aspect, but just to say it, they always had little snacks, which I know is not unusual for bars, but for gay bars, I think, you know, the cliche that like gays don't eat, or at least, you know,
right.
back in the day when people weren't being body positive or anything like that. The mere fact that they'd have like goldfish or wasabi peas, things like that. And that was always, well, especially if it's happy hour and you're drinking martini after martini, it was helpful to avoid a later situation.
Yeah, because those three or four goldfish are really going to absorb a lot of that.
It's better than nothing.
Now, the crowd that was at Barrage, how did that compare to the other bars? Was it as young as Vlada, or was it an older crowd, or who was there mostly?
You know, it was closer to Vlada, probably more diverse. But like you said earlier, they did have certain theme nights that brought in more diverse crowds on certain nights. And even overall, I do think it was a broader type of crowd than some of the other Hell's Kitchen bars. Age-wise, also maybe a bit wider of a range. And I think especially for like the happy hour, like the earlier kind of, you know, 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., much more diverse crowd, which is part of what I liked about it. I do think once it got into that later hour, especially on the weekends, then it would turn into more of the like 20s, maybe 30s kind of white Hell's Kitchen crowd. Maybe because some of the people that were there earlier were like stopping off on their way from work, for example. They don't live in the area, perhaps, but wanted to hang out at the bar. Whereas those who lived in Hell's Kitchen tended to fall more into that sort of template. I would say it was somewhere in between.
Now, one comment I had seen about Barrage on the Gay Cities website said, quote, "The perfect place for a swanky cocktail. Be low-key, or fabulous in this cozy and unpretentious neighborhood bar. Does that sound like Barrage to you?
I mean, that sums it up perfectly. Yeah.
Come as you are, have a good time, and don't be afraid of a fancy cocktail.
Well, and actually, you know, like I said, I'm a martini guy, and you can't always trust a martini at a neighborhood bar. Right. Depending on what it is, you know, if it's a little divier, you might not want to go that route. Or not that a martini is all that complicated, but even some of the other cocktail drinks they had. And no matter what you ordered, from a beer or a vodka soda to a martini or something more specialty, they always nailed it. And I will also say the bartenders, I remember, I can picture one face in particular. But always very friendly, always easygoing, which, you know, as I'm sure you well know, is not always the case in gay bars, especially when they're like slinging and serving quickly. These guys were always very pleasant. And they would actually also have cocktail servers. Even though it was a very small space, they would have really cute cocktail servers kind of coming in and out, starting a little bit later, maybe like 6-ish. And, you know, this is the kind of place, here's how, you know, there's a certain kind of place that does this, and I always appreciate it. They're the ones that'll bring you the martini shaker because there's extra and leave it for you so that once you finish your drink, you can, like, get the dregs, although sometimes it would almost be enough for, like, an entire second drink. That's the kind of place that Barrage was.
That sounds really cool. So yeah. I'm going to ask you this question, but I'm pretty sure I already know the answer. If there was one gay bar that's no longer around that you could bring back and go to again, which bar would that be?
Do I have to pick from these three?
No, you can pick any one you want.
Well, you know, to be honest, I mean, I love Barrage, but it's not as much of an experience bar. I have a lot of memories at Barrage, but it wasn't the kind of place that I have, like, super vivid memories from. The place, this actually is a party, not a bar. I don't know if that counts.
Yeah,
but
go with that.
In college, there was I think it was a party called Opaline, Opaline. And I believe the venue was called Shelter. It was in a bit of a no man's land on something like 38th Street, It was in like 38th Street, 39th Street, kind of in that area between like 6th and 7th. So kind of right around Bryant Park. And it was a four-story club that had a roof. And every Friday night when I was in college, for at least two or three of the year, there was a gay party called Opaline. And that was just, you know, it was one of the first, like, it was a real club with, like, real sound systems, you know, huge amounts of space, you know, multiple bars on every floor, tons of, you know, must have held, the capacity must have been 400 or 500 people in total. And it was a little bit of a shit show, but that was kind of the, you know, as a 19-year-old, that was part of the appeal. I was able to get in despite being underage. They would have an open bar from 10 to midnight, which, like, in retrospect is kind of insane. I don't know how they manage that. But I remember, like, maybe it's because I was younger and it was some of the first experiences I was having like that. But to kind of have access to this enormous club and be going with a group of friends, and it was different music on different floors. So they'd have, like, house on one floor, R&B and kind of hip hop on another floor, pop on a third floor. And then they had this rooftop, a big rooftop that anyone could just go up to and hang out. And it was just like, it was like this perfect combination of so many different great things. The energy was really great. The open bar was great as a college student. And I had a lot of really amazing experiences there with friends. So even though it didn't last that long and it was a party and not a venue, there's just something about that, those moments and those evenings that have always stuck with me.
Very cool. So growing up in that area, in the New York City metropolitan area there, and, you know, coming to the realization that you were gay, what kind of impact did the bar scene have on you? Was it a sense of relief, a sense of community, a sense of belonging? What How did you feel when you first discovered that kind of gay scene up there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was all of those things. Certainly belonging was a big part of it, but also it was unnerving because I came out when I was a junior in high school. So I was 16, 17, but I was very sort of timid about gay stuff. And I remember like even just going into the Big Cup, which was a pretty well-known gay coffee shop in Chelsea at the time, was like hard for me, let alone a bar. And obviously, you know, being underage too. So it was kind of a very gradual process to get comfortable going to those places, to kind of get my, you know, sort of self-image to the place where I could feel comfortable going into them. But once I did, and, you know, it was very much, you know, it matched a lot of what I envisioned it was, which was very cool. You know, I had positive experiences and I certainly made friends in gay bars because, like I said, in college, I didn't really have gay friends in college. I made all of my gay friends through bars and clubs. And I don't know where else, you know, again, like digital, online, social wasn't really a thing then. So as it was in the 70s and 80s and earlier, you know, there were not really many other ways to meet gay guys. So in that sense, it was a big part of, I think, helping me get started on my journey towards becoming more integrated into the community in that way, after having really wanted to be for years and years and years. Like I said, since having seen Queer as Folk and being like, I want to do that. That looks really fun. And one place, just to call it out, you've probably, I don't know if you've had people talk about this because it's very polarizing, but there was a bar called, or a club called Heaven in Chelsea. It was on 6th Avenue between, I want to say, 18th and 19th streets. And I'm sure you could fill a book with stories about Heaven. But Heaven was like, I think it may have been 18 plus, which is how I was able to go when I was younger. But that was also like a very formative place because that was probably one of, if not the first gay venues that I ever went to, in high school, even perhaps, it played a role in my in my evolution of understanding of sort of gay culture and gay life, at least from in a certain way. Heaven was very distant. Adam, have you come across Heaven at all?
Yes, yeah, actually, okay. There are several Heavens that are noteworthy. There was a Heaven in Manhattan that was pretty well known. There's one in London. There was one. I believe it was Houston, Texas. There were several of them, and they all seemed to embrace that kind of, you know, same vibe of, you know, kind of a heavy party scene and high energy and maybe a little sprinkle of debauchery in there. And so I can totally understand that. So after you had kind of entered the gay bar scene and started, you know, connecting more with the gay community, somehow over a period of time, that led you into being gay 100% of the time, at home, at work, everywhere. You now work with, I believe it's an advertising agency called Target 10, which is a premier advertising agency dealing with major corporations representing their products to the LGBT market. And you are the vice president of client services. So I'm guessing you spend a lot of your time talking to big wigs at, you know, in fancy corporate offices about how they should be representing their product to our community. Is that correct?
Yeah. And actually we're not even specifically focused on advertising. What we are is we're a consumer consultancy. So whereas some agencies or firms specialize in public relations or advertising or social media, we specialize in LGBTQ consumers. So if you're a company or a brand that's looking to connect and engage with LGBTQs overall or a particular slice of the community, gay men, lesbians, et cetera, we can help work with the company or the brand to understand what's the best way to approach it, put together plans, tactical plans, execute it, consult with them on it. And coincidentally, to kind of bridge all of these conversations, I'm working right now with a client specifically on reuniting through nightlife. So that's Bubbly, which is a sparkling water brand owned by Pepsi. And for the last couple of years, they've been very much about nightlife, the kind of intersection of getting ready, going out, and how that all plays into LGBTQ culture and community. And we're running a campaign with Bubbly right now that's all about celebrating kind of the getting back together that's happening in the nightlife context, because as you certainly well know, a lot of the folks in nightlife, especially in queer nightlife, drag queens, bartenders, they really suffered during the pandemic even more than, you know, our straight counterparts, in terms of losing jobs, having hours cut. So there's a lot of work being done, far more, you know, including by this brand, but by organizations, all sorts of other groups and entities to really help make sure that we're supporting all of these people that work in these places that have, you know, so little protections and yet are such a pivotal part and play such an important role in all of our cultural fabrics and developments and connections.
Now, Bubbly is a non-alcoholic product, correct?
That's right. They're kind of positioning themselves as a brand that's really great, you know, a product that's really great to like drink with your friends while you're getting ready to go out. You can use it as a cocktail mixer. It's like just sweet enough to pair really nicely with a variety of spirits. But generally speaking, actually, and I can send it to you after the interview if you want to include a link to it. They had a really great spot that came out with one of the most popular drag artists in the world right now, Aquaria, where she and her friends are just kind of getting ready to go back out here in New York City. You know, a couple of them are having a slice of pizza at the local pizzeria, another's on the subway platform, sees a party flyer, and they all kind of converge at this club for this kind of iconic moment. And that's, you know, it's the spirit of the spot was meant to capture what it feels like when you're under that disco ball. And I think it does it really nicely, and it's a nice reminder for all of us. I think even like pandemic aside, you know, especially like, you know, I'm 36 or I'm 37, forgot about that. I don't go out all that frequently, but when I do, when you do kind of finally get under that disco ball, it really does remind you like what an incredible feeling that is.
Absolutely. And it's nice to see that there are companies outside of the realm of liquor distributors that are kind of supporting the gay nightlife scene as well, because, you know, for decades we've seen, I think the one that broke the ice in the 80s was Absolute was the first one that came out, and all of a sudden every gay person in the world drank Absolute vodka. Now there's several others that have come on board equally strongly, including Stoli, which has done an incredible campaign of connecting with the gay consumer and embracing gay history of Harvey Milk and Stonewall and things like that. So it's refreshing to see in this time where, you know, there are so many people in the community who are struggling with issues of alcohol dependency or recovering alcoholics, that there's a company like Bubbly that's out there promoting an alternative that is still kind of, you know, sexy and clubby, but not alcohol.
Yeah, agreed. And they even have, like, on their website, they've got some recipes for both cocktails and mocktails. And I think just as a general comment, you know, I feel like the community is becoming much, much more open and accepting of sobriety and the, you know, the intermingling of sober folks with kind of nightlife and not making it feel like they have to be disconnected or not welcome or uninvited. I hope that's the case. I see that among some of my friends. It feels like we're kind of moving in that direction of just greater understanding of what these different things mean and why it doesn't really matter one way or the other. We can all kind of have a good time, whether we're drinking a martini or a bubbly.
Where have you been all my life? And Midnight in Brooklyn, you leaned in first. I wasn't looking, but there you were. Locked in a dark room, walking on air. Don't have to see you to know you're there. Dive all the way up, dancing on me, dancing on me.
Take me high.
Matt, we appreciate you taking the time to kind of walk us down memory lane and remember some of the clubs that you remember so fondly from New York City. And we'd certainly appreciate the work that you're doing with some of these corporate clients that are reaching out to the gay community in a more meaningful way than just slapping a rainbow on their label and saying, hey, you know, give us some of your gay dollars. So your contributions on both levels are much appreciated. And I hope you have a lot of continued success there in New York and with Target 10, and maybe even encounter a few new favorite bars now that there are some opening up in the city.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's really fun to tell these stories because my boyfriend and my friends have all heard them too many times. So it's nice to have a fresh audience.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.